In the world,
is that going to be?
It's a former British colony between Brazil, Venezuela, and Suriname. It is the only English-speaking country in South America. The indigenous tribes of Guyana call it the land of many waters in their native language. It's rich in biodiversity as well as minerals. And in the last decade, some 11 billion barrels of oil has been found, which is the most significant discovery of its kind in recent years. But as the world is moving towards greener economies, is it fair for countries like Guyana, struggling to overcome poverty and attract foreign investment, not to benefit from its newly found riches? In the next half hour, we'll hear what the country's president, the first Muslim to hold office, has to say about that. Guyanese President Irfan Ali talks to Al Jazeera. Irfan Ali, President of Guyana, thank you for talking to Al Jazeera.
Thank you very much. I'm very pleased to be here.
Let's start by talking about oil, the big topic these days here in Guyana. In 2015, when this big offshore oil deposit was discovered, what did you think?
We always knew the potential for hydrocarbon was there. But it came with great enthusiasm for us as a country because we are all aware of the potential of hydrocarbon in helping to transform economies and helping to put in key investment that can make your economy sustainable and so on.
But when the oil was discovered, did you think, wow, this is finally the lucrative opportunity we've been waiting for?
To answer your question in short, it was not, oh, wow, the heavens has opened up upon us. No. It was, here it is that we now have an opportunity to have much-needed revenues to push the macro agenda, the master plan of our country, to accelerate it and to bring prosperity to all the homes of our people. That was my thought.
And those reserves are huge. Last estimate I read was something like 11 billion barrels of oil. There are plans to produce 1 million barrels a day by, I believe it's 2027. When a country gets this kind of resource, sometimes they nationalize it. I suspect you didn't do that because of the time and expertise that would have been involved, but couldn't you explain to me why that wouldn't have been advantageous, might have given you more control, right?
First of all, for us, it is not about control. It is about having the best possible outcome for the country and the people. We don't believe that looking at best practices that we should move into a state-controlled sector. We believe that the best formula is one in which the government seek to have the best possible policies, agreements in place that will give the country and its people the greatest benefit, that will bring prosperity to every home. In our case, we have made it very clear that we are focusing on diversifying the economy, positioning Guyana as a leader in the region, if not the leader in food production. That is investment in the food production system, investment in infrastructure, opening up of new lands for food production, the buying of technology to ensure that you have resilience and sustainability, then positioning Guyana to be a leader in energy, not only fossil fuel, because we have tremendous potential in renewables, whether it's solar, hydro, tremendous potential in hydro, and then natural gas. So one of the things that has always been a hindrance to us here for manufacturing, industrial development, agro-processing is the cost of energy. With natural gas and the new project that we've announced, we'll be able to cut energy costs by 50%. That will take us from being one of the highest energy capital in the region to among the lowest energy capital. So no doubt, that will bring a lot of manufacturing, agro-processing, and industrial opportunities to us.
So you're making a lot of investments. Is that through direct government spending? Are you assisting industry? How does that work exactly?
So it's a mix. A lot of it has to do with government policies and programming of resources through the budget. So the direction in which the economy is going and the direction in which the country is going is supported by government expenditure to build infrastructure, to build the sectors, to open up the sectors. For example, opening up new lands for agriculture requires roads, requires drainage irrigation system. Helping the loggers and the miners requires a lot of investment in hinterland roads. Helping the housing drive that we have, you know, building 25,000 new homes, 50,000 new houses requires tremendous investment from the government, building out the healthcare system. But we are also seeing a lot of private investment that is coming in all these sectors. And that is because people are seeing the direction in which the country is going, the vision, where we are positioning Guyana. So we have investment in healthcare, investment in housing, private investment in education, educational services. The carbon is traded on international markets. So we have a mixture of government and private sector investment that is pushing this growth and development I'm speaking about.
All of that is funded with the oil money, which is boosting the economy. I believe the gross domestic product is supposed to go up something like 50% this year, which brings us back to that deal with the Exxon consortium. As I understand it, the nation and the companies split the revenues, but they take their expenses out first. So that delays some of the payback for the country, I guess. Is that a good deal?
We have addressed this many times. But let me just correct a statement you made. All of it is not funded by oil revenue. And we'll come back to that. Because the oil revenue goes through based on accountability measures we put in place. It goes through a budgetary process. So it passes through the parliamentary process. What we sought to do was to ensure that we extract maximum benefit from the implementation of that contract. And we have made it very clear, acknowledging that the contract the last government signed was not the best contract for Guyana. Acknowledging that, we have already committed to ensuring that future production sharing agreements are far different from that.
I'm sure you've heard skepticism about how this will go about. We talked to a gentleman from the Transparency Institute earlier today, and he said if you talk to the average Guyanese on the street, many of them would say they're not feeling the benefits of this money, and they're not sure that in the future they will. How do you respond to that?
Well, I don't know. Some people are self-appointed professors. I don't know what survey he did. But let me ask you, let me put this back to you now. When you're able to give your citizens the best possible health care, when you're able to announce measures that is giving every single citizen who require dialysis a check every year to help them with that dialysis, when you're able to give every school child a transportation grant to help them to go to school, when you're able to give them a uniform grant, when you're able to increase old age pension, when you're able to ensure that the primary health care is working at its best for the people, when you're able to build roads all across the country to reduce the cost of transportation, farm to market access road that reduce the cost of production, make the farmers more competitive, when you're able to expand and opening up tens of thousands of new acreage of land for agriculture, when you're able to deliver 50,000 house lots to people, when you're able to deliver a children and maternity hospital that is world class to reduce maternal death, when you're able to invest in cancer treatment, when you're able to invest in free education, 20,000 scholarship, when you're able to have a program that will see 150,000 Guyanese trained as coders, when I'm able to get Al Jazeera to come to Guyana because of oil, but I can use this opportunity to showcase the rest of Guyana, isn't there a benefit that is coming to the people? And I guess the same gentleman have children who is benefiting, and he himself is benefiting. And, you know, the sad thing is many of the mainstream media, you go to the U.S., you go to many countries that were built on oil and gas, built on fossil fuel. You won't ask, have the ordinary people felt the effect of fossil fuel, revenues from fossil fuel? But in small developing states, especially countries that are termed third world, we believe that sometimes, you know, oh, they don't know how to use their revenue. They don't know how to use their resource. They need always a guiding light to guide them on how to use their resource. We have a very clear plan. We have a very definitive plan. And that plan includes all of humanity. Let me be very clear. I've made it clear. The prosperity of Guyana must lead to the prosperity of the region, the CARICOM region, and the region around us. We want to contribute positively to humanity. That is why we have the lowest deforestation rate in the world. We could have done, like many countries, cleaned the forest up a long time ago. That is why we are pursuing a low-carbon development strategy 2030. That is why I'm not telling you that we're going to bring fossil fuel on shore and generate all our energy. We are working on a hydro plant. And for someone to say they don't understand how this is translating to the benefit is someone who is actually naive or someone who does not want to acknowledge the transformation that is taking place. And sometimes you have to understand it is politically driven. Small societies like these, you have many actors who shelter under the umbrella of independence but are very politically charged and politically driven. And I'm very frank speaker, so I'll tell you that. Let me move to the issue as we speak about the guide from transparency, about transparency. When we came into government, there was an $80 million U.S. signing bonus that the country knew nothing about. It was signed by the last government. So we understand immediately that we needed to take measures that never occur again. So we said we're going to create tremendous distance between the government and the management of the revenue. We set up the Natural Resource Fund with the new laws governing the Natural Resource Fund. What does the fund do? First of all, the fund removes the responsibility from the minister. A board has been established, an independent board, to manage the fund. All the revenue that comes in to the country must be paid into that fund. There is no way you can send it to any other fund. As soon as that money is paid into the fund, there must be a public declaration, not only on a website, but gazetted. If the minister failed to declare that, within 30 days, there's a mandatory jail term of 10 years. That is what we put in place, a mandatory jail term of 10 years. Outside of that, outside of the fund, the distance from the minister, the mandatory jail terms, the declaration of the fund, how is revenue extracted from the fund? Every cent that comes out of the fund that is spent in the country must clear parliamentary approval. There must be prior parliamentary approval. So the opposition, the country, the legislature, the separate arm of government is now involved in approving that fund. It's not the state. It's not the state.
So you've got that safeguards in place, is what you're saying.
Tremendous safeguard. Then there is an investment committee that is separate and independent. There is a steering committee that is established as separate and independent. All of these safeguards are there because we understand. We do not want to be another example of a badly managed oil and gas sector. We want to be one of the examples that people can point to with pride. That is why we have put all this system in place.
And that brings me to, I think, where all of these questions come from is the resource curse that other countries have experienced when they have come into natural resources, and those resources haven't always been distributed throughout society. They haven't always improved the culture and the economy of countries for everybody in the country. So how do you avoid that? And I'll bring up an example. Trinidad and Tobago has been criticized for its oil development, leaving environmental catastrophe, not really distributing the money around the country. How do you avoid those kinds of examples? Is it simply these safeguards, or isn't it also those choices you make about where to invest?
That's right. So it's not, first of all, I addressed this issue before. It's, you know, I don't like people saying it's a resource curse. Because if you have a resource, you're saying it's a curse. And if you don't have a resource, you're saying it's a curse too. It is always, we must be frank enough to say it has been a management and people curse. Because it is bad management and decisions that are made by people that has made this resource become a negative instead of a positive. That is why we are very careful in what we are going to do as a country.
And one of the obstacles you face here is the relationship with Venezuela. Venezuela disputes some territory. It's harassed fishermen, seized oil vessels, and there is the prospect of a dispute over oil offshore. How big of a problem for you is that?
Well, first of all, we take every matter seriously. There is a controversy. We have gone to the ICJ. The matter is before the ICJ. We are very clear on where our borders are, very, very clear. I mean, there's a map somewhere here that depicts the map of Guyana and where our borders are. So we are very clear on where our borders are. But we respect international law. We respect the value system of international law. That is why we went to the ICJ. The first aspect of the case was jurisdiction. The court has already ruled that they have jurisdiction. We have encouraged Venezuela to participate. We continue to encourage Venezuela to participate fully in the ICJ and to respect the outcome of the ICJ.
And all this oil we've been talking about doesn't include two fines that Exxon announced. That is the Sailfin 1 and Yarrow 1 wells offshore. Tell me about that. What do you know? Is there a lot of oil out there?
Well, it is clear that there is a lot of oil in our offshore blocks. I anticipate that our discoveries will become more frequent and our reserve will grow, will continue to grow. But outside of oil, there is also the potential for gas. And there are some fields that are that have high gas potential. So we are looking now also at a national gas strategy, because this will become an important part of the energy mix, energy transition and investment that we are looking at in the future.
Right now, about, correct me if I'm wrong, 40% of Guyanese live in poverty, is that about right? You have this opportunity now with the growing oil wealth, the growing GDP. What do you hope to do with those numbers in the next several years?
Well, it's less than 40%, but let me say this. one of the important things that we must do is to improve disposable income at every household, to give people access to basic facilities, water, electricity, food, and those things we have put in place. We understand what it takes to manage a country without resources. So we more than understand the responsibility that comes with managing a country with resource, with this opportunity to transform the lives of every single person.
So you think you can make a dent in those poverty numbers?
I'm saying to you, look at the latest report, the gender gap report that came out last year. You will see the magnificent improvement of Guyana. We move, I think, what? We move, we've improved by more than 35 places or more, the gender gap report. Look at the number, look at our enrollment rate, right? So I'm saying not only will we put a dent in that, a significant dent into that, but we are creating and moving in a direction in which more people will move to a position in which not only basic poverty level is addressed, but the issue of empowerment, disposable income is addressed to the extent that more persons will be graduating to the middle class.
Are there lessons for other countries that you've already learned in this process? You've got neighbors like Suriname, which will be developing its own oil reserves. Have you had any cautionary tales?
Well, one of the things that we have learned very early is that there must be a lot of public education. There must be a critical involvement in local stakeholders. And we have passed the local content legislation. But I think very early on in this process, the local stakeholders and local content has to be mainstream into everything we do. Because you will end up in a situation where basic services that nationals can provide are provided by external, for like rental of vehicles, simple services. So the involvement of local content and local stakeholders is critical to this path, or this evolution, if you want to put it that way.
Well, as you are developing these massive oil reserves, which would make you an international powerhouse when it comes to oil exports, across the globe, because of carbon, for other reasons, the world is trying to move away from oil. Do you feel at all like you're in a race against time here to exploit what you have as the world transitions to other energy sources?
There's a reality facing us. We are aware of that reality. That is why we have to make the best use of what we have in the quickest possible time. I have already explained to you that the cost of capital is going up, the access to capital is going up for fossil fuel related industries. You have to do it in a responsible way, in a sustainable way, but you cannot allow this great natural natural asset not to be deployed for the improvement of your country, the region, and the people of your country. So we understand that, yes, it's a race against time. It must be done responsibly, though, in a sustainable way. But we intend to accelerate the production. I've said this before. We intend to accelerate the production, but at the same time, keeping it safe and ensuring that our macro perspective in terms of the environment, climate change, the forests, the different sectors I spoke to you about, that those also grow and improve at the same pace at which we want the oil and gas sector to grow at.
Speaking of those forests, this country is made up of about three-quarters rainforest, I mean, 75% of the country. You talked a little about the carbon credits.
A lot more than 75%.
A lot more?
A lot more than 75%.
Okay. Well, then, a massive proportion of this country is covered in rainforest, which, as you say, helps the world get carbon out of the air. What efforts are you making to preserve those rainforests?
Well, first of all, the fact that the forest is standing there, look around us and you will see that it did not need to be standing there. We could have exploited this a long time ago and bring in lots of revenue for our country. It is still standing there. So it can tell you that the effort that we have put into ensuring it is still standing there. Not only standing, but with the lowest deforestation rate, we are even extracting less than what we are permitted to do. A forest that is monitored by international standard, we voluntarily allow that. A forest that stores 19.5 gigatons of carbon. The question is not what we are doing, what has the world done to help us to keep it? What has the world done to give us the incentive that we so richly deserve for keeping it? What has the world done to acknowledge the fact that we have kept it?
So other countries need to do more.
Of course, especially those who try to set the standard. Because what is the price for carbon credit today as against what it should be? What is the cost for climate mitigation and adaptation as against what is being given as grants and loans? Great disparity, but that conversation escapes us. Because many of the players who have already developed from fossil fuel are now, you know, keeping this discussion only on fossil fuel. But what about this country that has kept our forests alive? So we are not waiting on anyone. We are working now in the carbon market, the voluntary carbon market. We hopefully very soon our forests will be art certified, one of the only forests, maybe, and to see how we can ensure that the standing forests also earn. Because at the end of the day, we have people to take care of. We have a country and a region to take care of. And whilst we understand, acknowledges, and continue to do our part on climate change, keeping the lungs of the world going, we must also understand that we have to earn. We have to earn, and our people must live also. And that is why we are deploying this asset on the carbon credit market, which I'm sure will bring tremendous added revenue to our country. And not only revenue, but in the low carbon development strategy, we have earmarked specific percentage that must be go from revenues earned under the LCDS that must go to the upliftment of hinterland community or indigenous people. That is how we respect their rights, that there is a percentage that goes to the development of indigenous communities and people across our country.
Irfan Ali, President of Guyana, thank you for talking to Al Jazeera.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure. And please, feel free at any time.